Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
Oh, give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now.
Hello, and welcome to our latest podcast. I'm here, I'm Peter Hart, I'm with lovely Gary Bain, who's as voluptuous as ever. He's slightly more voluptuous than he used to be, but there you go. What are we doing today, Gary? It's a bit of a special for me.
Today, it's a special episode on one man, and that man is Manfred von Richthofen, known otherwise as the Red Baron.
Ooh, is he evil?
No.
I think a lot. There's a song about him, isn't
there? There's a number of songs about him, and there was a Snoopy character based upon him, I think I recall.
I think Snoopy was the one who killed him. Anyway, should we sing the song just to get rid of half our listeners?
Yeah, okay.
Bugger the listeners, as Matt used to say. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more. The bloody Red Baron was right at the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of that bloody Red Baron of Germany.
Right, if we got anybody left, when was he born, Pete?
Well, he was born on the 2nd of May, 1892. He's the son of an aristocratic Prussian family, so he is probably he's a real baron, if you know what I mean. And he grew up with a taste for hunting. Dun, 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 dun. He started his military service as an officer cadet when he was 11.
11? Wow.
And progressed through a somewhat lengthy and rather strict training before he was commissioned into the cavalry in 1912. He served on both Eastern and Western fronts at the start of the war, but he felt that the trench warfare was unexciting. be exciting enough for me, I think. And in May 1915, he got a transfer into the German Air Service. How do you think he started? Do you think he just leapt into a plane and took off?
Yeah, of course. They all did at that time, didn't they? Just jumped in, off they went, and trial and error.
We've got our podcast on Graham Donald showed that some of them did. Now, first he was an observer, but he had a chance meeting with that supremely brilliant ace, Oswald Bulker, and that inspired him to learn to fly, which he went through the normal flying training course, and proved himself a competent and aggressive pilot. We're not doing his early background because I don't know much about it. Do you know much about his early flying career?
Oh, I know loads, but we haven't got time.
Oh, okay, well. And he selected for Bulker's Jaster 2, which was forming at Bertincourt, and he joins on 1st September 1916. How do you think Bulker was with young pilots that he was recruiting?
He was a bit of a tutor, wasn't he? He wasn't just with Richthofen. He was known for being a bit of a sort of person to look up to for all these young protégés. And he taught them the real basics of aerial warfare. He was very...
The dicta.
He was very meticulous, yes.
The dicta, which we'll come into later, because it's the same as Richthofen's dicta, surprisingly, so we don't want to go through it twice. But Richthofen was taught almost everything over that month or two that they had together in the Jasta. Now, so what was Richthofen's first victory? Well, it occurs on the 17th of September. The fighting in the air had boiled up after the Battle of Flers Courcelette had started, on the 15th of September, and on the 17th of September, Richthofen shoots down an FE-2B crewed by veterans Lieutenant Lionel Morris and Tom Rees. There's a book about this, which I still haven't reviewed, which I recommend. If you just look up for it, you'll find it. Now, they have no chance, these two lads. They're veterans. They had actually killed. They had shot down planes themselves. They're not raw. But there is somebody who's raw. Who's that? It's Richthofen. Didn't know his arse from his elbow would be the usual expression that you'd use.
Yeah, but we've had this discussion before, haven't we, about you describe it as a roller coaster, how there's a roller coaster of advances in technology or tactics that put one side in the ascendancy. And his albatross was totally, totally outclassing the FE-2B at that point.
Now, you've got a quote you're going to read. So this is Lieutenant Manfred von Richter, Jasta 2. Give vein to your inner Richthofen.
My opponent had apparently lost sight of me. Instead of twisting and turning, he flew straight along. In a fraction of a second, I was at his back with my excellent machine. I gave a short burst of shots with my machine gun. I had gone so close that I was afraid I might dash into the Englishman. Suddenly, I nearly yelled with joy, for the propeller of the enemy machine had stopped turning. The English machine was swinging curiously to and fro. Probably something had happened to the pilot. The observer was no longer visible.
Now, these quotes are taken from the Red Air Fighter. Now, I want to make it quite clear that this is a ghosted book. But I think the essence of Richthofen still shines through. The ghostwriter will have taken what Richthofen said to him and put it into German. And it's then translated into English. So we're a fair away from Richthofen's original words, but it's all we've got. He was on his way to being, well, he would be the biggest scourge of the Royal Flying Corps. The Albatross is better than any Allied scout then flying on the Western Front. And I always think it's funny, the Albatross D1, I tell you, it's a curse on the House of Heart. And the Albatross D2 arrives. Before the Royal Flying Corps has got any chance to do anything. But there is one silver lining in October. One little ray of sunshine for the Royal Flying Corps. What's that, Gary?
Well, it's the accidental death of Oswald Bolker. He crashes in midair on the 28th of October, 1916.
Yeah, but in one sense, his work was done, wasn't it? Because he's only 25. These guys are so young, and you know, you think of Bolker as the old master, the old master. But he's 25, an age that its relevance will become.
But it wasn't just Richthofen, was it? The whole of Jasta 2 had learnt their craft from Bolker by this stage. They were good.
Yeah, and Richthofen had already shot down 6 claimed aircraft by this time, and he will take on the mantle of Bolker. Now, one of Richthofen's greatest battles occurs on, most famous rather than greatest, I suspect, occurs on the 23rd of November 1916, when he encounters the British ace, Major Lano Hawker, who was a Victor, a VC, who was flying a DH-2. Now, you've looked up a bit about Hawker. He's one of my favourites. I think you like him as well.
Yeah, I mean, he got his VC for shooting down, I think, 3 aircraft in succession over Ypres, over the Langemarck area, I think it was, in July 1915. And at that stage, he'd had 7 victories, which at that stage of the war made him an ace. And he is one of our favourites, Pete, because he had issued an order
to 24 Squadron,
which was, Pete,
attack everything.
Yeah, no misunderstanding, Matt, very succinct.
And he was also, as a major, he wasn't really supposed to fly. Now, this was honoured in the disobedience, if you like, rather than anything else. But what I like about Hawker was he used to fly when pilots were sweating on leave. You know what I mean? They were just nervous because they wanted to go home and see the missus or go and see the girlfriend or the dog or whatever they wanted to see. And he'd fly for them. He was a brave man, Hawkey. Probably flew more than anybody else as a result. Anyway, he's up on the 23rd of November. He gets separated from the rest of his patrol, and he encounters Richtofen. Now, all he's got in the DH2 to match the Albatross D1 is that he can turn round and round in circles, in narrower circles than the Albatross could manage. But what does that benefit compared to a DH2 single Lewis gun with how many rounds in a drum?
Gary? Oh, somewhere between 42 and 47, I think, Pete.
According to me.
Yeah.
Shut up.
But I mean, the point you're making is that the Lewis gun's totally inadequate when compared to the belt-fed twin German Spandau.
Yeah, dagger, dagger, dagger. And I mean dagger, dagger, dagger. Anyway, here we are. We have Richtofen again. And I'm afraid it's him that tells the story of the combat. This is very much an edited down version.
The circles which we made round one another were so narrow that their diameter was probably no more than 250 or 300 feet. I had time to take a good look at my opponent. If he had not had his cap on, I would have noticed what kind of a face he was making. When he had come down to about 300 feet, he tried to escape by flying in a zigzag course, which makes it difficult for an observer on the ground to shoot. That was my most favourable moment. I followed him at an altitude of from 250 to 150 feet, firing all the time. The Englishman could not help falling.
Now, the DH2s, a lot of the aircraft the British had flown so successfully in the Somme, it was a success, see our podcast about it, but they'd had their day. But there was nothing at the time ready to replace them. Now, late January 1917, Richtofen's posted to take command of Jaster 11. They were near Douai. He's not pleased. Why do you think he's not pleased to be sent from his squadron?
Well, because he's starting from scratch again with a squadron at that time had not really had any success at all.
They hadn't shot anyone down. That's right. But they couldn't have got a better teacher and leader. And he was imbued, Gary, with the spirit of Oswald Bolka and his dicta. He was also flying, although not for long, the Albatross D3. I always love this. This is where the Germans have got D1 and D2 Albatross. Brilliant. D3, they think, well, I like the look of that the wing shape of the Nieuport. We'll copy it. So they copied it and the wings kept flying off. Richtofen doesn't fly that one for long. Anyway, Richtofen does something to mark himself out, and this is part of the legend of the Red Baron. What does he do, Gary?
Well, you're giving it away there, Pete. He decides to adopt an all red paint scheme. Now, this is deliberate. It's to mark himself out in the air and to thereby strike fear into his enemies. And it was the beginning of the enduring legend of the Red Baron.
So, like, it's trailing his coat across the skies in a pub conflict, of which you must be an aficionado, yes. And it doesn't take long for Richtofen to get a grip and to show the way forward to his new Jaster 11. He leads from the front and his score starts to mount. And we can't go through every one of the 80 or so he shoots down, 80 or less, just less. But on 24th of January, there's a sort of typical one. There's seven FE-2Bs. Now, you know the FE-2B. We've talked about them before. Two-seater, pusher, very difficult to shoot down, very tough machine, very useful, has a long career throughout the war, ended up as a night bomber. And they were, two of them were equipped with input cameras, and they were to take the photographs of Vimy Ridge. Why would they be photographing Vimy Ridge in January 1917?
Well, because we've said this before, the importance of aircraft in support of the troops on the ground, either in defence or, in this case, in attack. You know, it saves lives.
What are we getting ready for? Is it the Battle of Arras?
It's the Battle of Arras.
In April. So they're photographing on a daily basis, and they have to get the photos. So Captain Oscar Gregg is with his observer, Lieutenant John McLennan, and they're piloting the one of the FE-2Bs that's going to take the photographs. Now, they start their run, and the two are completely engrossed in trying to get this sort of tight mosaic structure. Now, by mosaic, I mean that so each square of each photograph just slightly overlaps so that when you get back to base, you've got a complete map of the trenches. But it's not easy. It takes a lot of concentration, doesn't it?
Well, it's not only concentration, Pete. I want people to listen to the description that Oscar Grigg gives of how he's standing and what he's doing.
Fair enough. And also remember that the escort. Now, there are five escorts, but where are they? It's difficult to judge how close. If they're close, then they're part of the formation. If they're far away, then they're far away. And this time they get it wrong. So this is, listen to this. This is Captain Oscar Grigg. I was standing up on the radar bar looking from map to the ground, getting the machine in exactly the right position and keeping it on an even keel, the camera being a fixed one. The observer was looking through the camera sights and was just beginning to take the exposure.
So my point there is it starts with, I was standing up on the radar bar.
And he's looking from the map to the ground to get in exactly the right position. Does that mean he's looking over his shoulder to see if Richtofen or anybody else is behind?
No. They're completely reliant on the escort, aren't they?
And the observer's standing in the front cockpit and looking over and into the camera. Now, the escort's drifted away, and at the moment of maximum advantage, as you would expect, Richtofen strikes. And this is Captain Oscar Grigg, also 25 Squadron, of course. What does Oscar Grigg say? Oh, it's me again. I tell you, it's a curse on the House of Heart. I heard a machine gun and saw several bullet holes appear in the left wing. I turned to the right in a steep bank, nearly upsetting my observer. I'd have been bloody upset. Furious, hoping to get the enemy in front of me and also to get back to my escort. But on the completion of half a circle, the enemy fired another burst from the right side, putting the engine out of action and hitting me in the right ankle and knocking the foot off the rudder bar. So this is severely impacting his ability to control the aircraft. And I wouldn't like a bullet hitting me in the right ankle. I'd probably make somewhat more fuss about it, wouldn't you? It must have been a tremendous shock, wasn't it? Just a few shattering moments. And this is what happens to John McLennan. And it's going to be you.
I was actually taking photographs when a burst of machine gun fire from behind notified the attack. I looked round and perceived a red enemy machine diving away. In the first attack, he shot through both oil and petrol tanks and splintered the propeller.
So, put out the engine, hit the oil and petrol tanks, splintered the propeller and hit the pilot. Yeah, it's not going well for them, is it?
In the first attack.
Now, Richtofen had learned that the FE-2B was all but defenceless if you came at it from below and behind. The observer could stand up and shoot over the top wing, but he can't shoot below and behind. So Captain Oscar Grigg says, I continued in circles, endeavouring to get a sight of the enemy, but he succeeded in keeping below and behind me. I saw several tracer bullets pass through the instrument port between me and my observer. The firing stopped and we made for the lines, but at this turn, the observer pointed behind the machine, indicating another attack. A second later, a small scarlet biplane passed over us and went away to the right. So they've got a useless engine. They drifted out of the sky, rigged off and on their tail. I think they've had it. Are these voices from heaven?
The machine could only glide, and the manoeuvrability was greatly impaired through lack of any engine power. Von Richtofen attacked all the way down till the machine was but a few hundred feet from the ground. He attacked each time from below and behind, in which position we were unable to return fire.
So there they are. In actual fact, they do manage to get down and they destroy their aircraft, but they haven't taken the photograph. So another mission would have to be flown. Now, that's what happens. Richtofen has spotted his wing weakness. He finds his airplane suffering in that combat. He crash lands. And he switched to the Halberstadt D2 Scout for a while. Anyway, throughout March and into April, that April becomes known as Bloody April because the why is it called Bloody April? What are the two air forces doing?
Well, the German air force is trying to prevent the British Army cooperation aircraft from carrying out their duties, while as far as possible protecting their own reconnaissance aircraft.
And of course, it's the vice versa, the British scout. Now, there is something that we need to point out here. When you read accounts of the time, you often hear that the Germans outnumber the British. Is this true?
No. They've got superior aircraft, but they themselves were badly outnumbered, and they had to adopt a cautious defensive posture, which allowed them to concentrate their numbers and fight only in the circumstances that they considered to be to their advantage.
So when there's more Germans, it's because they've concentrated their powers to hit a particular target. It's crucial that they don't get shot down, because they can't afford to be shot down, because for their country, not just for themselves. Me and you would be thinking of ourselves, but they're thinking that we are a valuable resource. There's not many of us. We've got to be careful. Can you remove all the risks in a dogfight, for instance? Is it possible, Gary?
No, of course not. And I think, we'll come on to some examples later. Some of it, survival is often just, luck, that the round hits a particular part of the aircraft rather than, say, the petrol tank. It's just, if your number's up, as it were, your number's up.
Now, we've got another example, which we're going to follow through. On 6th of March, Richthofen attacks a patrol of... Now, this is my all-time favourite aircraft name. Not the Spitfire or the stupid Hurricane. The Sopwith 1.5 Strutter. Now, look, can you imagine the romance that just wonderful. Now, this had a forward-firing machine gun. It was a tractor aircraft, i.e. the propeller was in front. It had been a good aircraft on the Somme, but it was now obsolescent or outdated. This patrol, it's led by Lieutenant Alan Dorr of 43 Squadron. As an escort, it has some FE-8s, that's a single-seater pusher, from 40 Squadron. And there's a sort of wild dogfight all over the skies. And this is Lieutenant Alan Dorr. In a few seconds, we were in a general melee, of which I can only remember vague instance, as in a vivid dream. Dived at one wicked-looking scout with a red fuselage. Dun, 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 dun. Gun jammed after a few shots. I have confused recollections of seeing machines diving absolutely vertically, others stalling and spinning, the whole formation revolving and intermingling, scattering, converging like swallows on a wing. And then suddenly, Richthofen is hit. What? No, have I made a mistake? Looks at notes. No, Richthofen's hit just as he's about to administer the coup de grace to one of his enemies. You're going to be Lieutenant Manfred von Richthofen in extremis.
He started shooting prematurely, which showed that he was nervous. So I said to myself, go on shooting, you won't hit me. At the moment, I think I laughed out loud, but I soon got a lesson. In my mind's eye, I saw my enemy dropping. I approached my man up to within 50 yards. I fired some well-aimed shots and thought that I was bound to be successful. But suddenly, I heard a tremendous bang when I had scarcely fired 10 cartridges. And presently again, something hit my machine. It became clear to me that I had been hit, or rather my machine. At the same time, I noticed a fearful stench of petrol, and I observed that the motor was running slack. The Englishman noticed it too, for he started shooting with redoubled energy while I had to stop.
Now, here we have a thing of luck, because this could easily have been the end of Richthofen, very easily. He's surrounded by a spray of petrol, and at any moment, his whole aircraft could have just burst into flames. Now, Richthofen, he's got experience. He knows he's in danger. He's seen these symptoms of imminent immolation a lot in the air. So he reacts instantly. What does he do?
Instinctively, I switched off the engine. When one's petrol tank has been holed and when the infernal liquid is squirting around one's legs, the danger of fire is very great. One had in front of one an engine of more than 150 horsepower, which is red hot. If a single drop of petrol should fall on it, the whole machine would be in flames. I left in the air a thin white cloud. I knew its meaning from my enemies. Its appearance is the first sign of a coming explosion. I had no idea with what rapidity I went downwards. At any rate, the speed was so great that I could not put my head out of the machine without being pressed back by the rush of air.
Now, it could still have been the end because he's still got to land. He's coming down almost vertically. He's got to flatten out, but he manages it and he makes a successful controlled landing. I think Richtofen, he's lucky to survive this, but he'd been overconfident, hadn't he? Do you not think?
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you think this was a valuable lesson to him?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one more. He adds to the educational process that's going to make him the most complete fighting ace of the First World War. He does learn from these experiences.
Now, the rest of the pilots in Jastra 11, they're coming along. They're being taught, but they're aware of the risks. You could hear it, the red fighter, the scarlet fighter. Everybody is starting to learn who Richtofen is. And they, by painting his aircraft all red, he's marking himself out to his enemies. So what do the lads in his Jastra decide to do?
Well, this inspires them, and they decide to join him in trailing their metaphorical coats across the Arras skies, and they paint their aircraft red with different coloured trims to mark them all out, and this is the...
So a yellow trim or a green trim, and mostly red.
And this is where the flying circus comes from, isn't it?
It is. Also because they moved up and down the front, especially in 17. But yeah, that's
exactly it. And they lived in big tents.
No, they didn't, Gary. Stop getting carried away with your excitement. Now, there's one. This is one of my all-time favourite things. And when I used to do this talk live, it was a bit I used to look forward to. Because on 13th of April, this is during Bloody April, we're fighting the Battle of Arras. We've got to get up in the skies. And there's an utter disaster when 59 Squadron sends a patrol of six of the new Corps Artillery Observation Photographic Reconnaissance Machine, which is the RE8, known as the Harry Tate for obvious reasons. And they're set out on a photographic reconnaissance. It's a new aircraft. They're not that familiar with it. And it's off towards the Drocourt-Queant switch line, which is unfortunately very near Douai. The escort doesn't arrive. I forgot. Sorry. I forgot to set my alarm. Sure, nothing will go wrong. What happens? Well, Richtofen arrives with five of his scouts, the Jastra, and all six RE8s are shot down. And afterwards, the survivors and the Jastra pilot meet in the officer's mess. And this quote shows that Richtofen seems to lack a sense of humour because it's just brilliant. Just listen to this. This is just perfect.
One of the Englishmen whom we had shot down and whom we had made prisoner was talking to us. Of course, he inquired after the red aeroplane. It is not unknown, even among the troops in the trenches, and is called by them Le Diable Rouge. In the squadron to which he belonged, there was a rumour that the red machine was occupied by a girl, a kind of Joan of Arc. He was intensely surprised when I assured him that the supposed girl was standing in front of him. He did not intend to make a joke. Oh, I think he did.
I can just imagine, shot down, bit pissed off, you're having a nice drink, and there's this pompous German arse in front of you. He just couldn't resist it, could he? Also, the idea that British Tommies call anything Le Diable Rouge as opposed to Red Fokker.
Yeah.
Something.
Oh, look, mate, there's that Diable Rouge up there again.
Oh, dear. Now, by 29th of April, Richtofen shot down innumerable aircraft. He shoots down four aircraft on that day alone. All right, but he reached 52 kills. Quick word about kills: most of them have been checked and found real, but there'll never be a precision, entire precision, because it's difficult to assess kills. Do you think Richtofen is at his peak?
Yeah, he is, but he's not a wild force like Albert Ball, for example, Captain Albert Ball. But he's a cool, calculating formation leader, and he's able to secure the maximum advantage from any situation. And he's got the moral strength to avoid engaging in battle if he felt the odds were stacked against him. Now, that's not cowardice, Pete.
That's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, also, you know, it's preserving, you mentioned earlier, it's not just the aircraft that are the precious resource, it's the pilots. So it's preserving the pilots as well.
And war isn't a game, is it? It's not a game. And, now, let's talk a bit. I mean, why is Richthofen one of the great pilots? Well, firstly, he's got individual personal skills. So he can fly an aircraft accurately. He's a dead shot. He's the rest of it. He can do all that. He's a great formation leader tactically. And we'll talk about that a bit more. But he's also a great teacher. And this, he's moulding the young pilots of Jastra 11 into one of the most deadly collection of aces that would ever prey on the British. Within 3 months, the pilots of Jastra 11 would eventually collectively make over 100 kills. There's great names like Alman Roder, Kurt von Wolf. There's Manfred von Richthofen's brother, Lothar von Richthofen. This is amazing.
And this is from a starting point of zero.
Yeah. And at the end of April, Richthofen goes on leave. And so we're going to have to leave it. But he leaves behind his brother and the rest of these aces still cutting a swathe through the skies. He's done a brilliant job, not just as an individual pilot, a killing machine, as a formation leader, but as a teacher. Now, he returns to action in June 1917, where he's flying over, remember, the air war is secondary to the ground war. Why do you think he's moved in June to the skies of Flanders?
Because that's where the action is, in fact.
Because the Battle of Messines and boiling up to the Third Battle of Ypres. Now, on this occasion, let's talk with... I want to be clear. During this talk, we three times talk about times when Richthofen is in trouble. This is not the usual. But the usual are the ones we've discussed where he shoots down people. But these are the exciting bits of his career that we've got to deal with. 6th of July, he attacks a flight of the obsolescent FE-2Ds. That's an FE-2B with a couple of letters later in the chain, isn't it? Richthofen and a couple of other pilots, and by this time it's the Jagdschwader, which is the flying circus proper, Jagdschwader 1. And in the scrap that follows, two of the German Albatross attack head-on an FE-2D pilot, which is piloted by Captain Donald Cunnell with the Observer's second lieutenant, Albert Woodbridge. Now, I'm going to be Albert Woodbridge, and he tells what happens. I recall that there wasn't a thing on that machine that wasn't red. And God, how he could fly. I opened fire with the front Lewis, and so did Cunnell with his side gun. Cunnell held the FE to a course, and so did the pilot of the all-red Scout. Gad! With our combined speed, we must have been approaching each other at somewhere near 250 miles per hour. Thank God my Lewis didn't jam. I kept a steady stream of lead pouring into the nose of that machine. He was firing also. I could see my tracers splashing along the barrels of his Spandaus. I knew the pilot was sitting behind them. His lead came whistling past my head and ripping holes in my bathtub. Then something happened. We could hardly have been 20 yards apart when the Albatross pointed her nose down suddenly. Zip! And she passed under us. We saw the all-red plane slip into a spin. It turned over and over and round. It was no manoeuvre. It was completely out of control. His motor was going full on. So I figured I'd at least wounded him. Now, I want to make one point before you leave your account as acting as Richthofen. He's being overconfident again. How do you attack an FE-2B? Or D, same thing, same machine, basically, from behind and below. Not from in front, where you're facing the observer with his Lewis gun. Anyway, you're going to leave your own account. Tell us what you think of this, Richthofen.
Suddenly, I received a blow on my head. I was hit. For a moment, my whole body was completely paralysed. My hands dropped to the side, and my legs dangled in the fuselage. The worst part was that the blow of the head affected my optic nerve, and I was completely blinded. The machine plunged down. For a moment, it flashed through my mind that this is the way it looks just before death. I doubted if the winds could stand the strain, and I expected that they would break off at any moment. I did not lose consciousness immediately. I fought to regain control of my arms and legs so that I could grasp the control stick. I managed to shut off the fuel and the ignition. But would that alone help me? I had moved my eyes around and taken my goggles off, but it was impossible to see even the sun. I was completely blinded. The seconds were an eternity to me. I continued to fall.
He's incredibly lucky because just by his own account, at the last second almost, he gets a partial vision and he manages to land safely and then he faints. It's been such a close escape. Overconfidence. It's just ridiculous. He's made a severe mistake. It's the first sign of him breaking his own rules. What's happened to him? Well, what's happened to you as Richtofen?
Well, he suffered a fractured skull, Peter, from a glancing bullet, and it had torn through to the bone. Yeah, and so he's rushed to hospital. It's quite a serious injury.
Now, it appears at first that his recovery is swift because he's back in the air by 16th of August. 16th of August? 16th of August? Hang on. He was only wounded on the 6th of July. So it's only about 5 or 6 weeks. It's ridiculous. But he's a changed man, isn't he? And he's suffering. What's he suffering from? And this will be no surprise with a fractured bloody skull.
Well, he now gets bothered in the air by intermittent headaches, dizziness and nausea, which is not good for a pilot.
I bet he's also a bit more conscious of his own mortality. He's not quite so invincible, is he? And it may or may not have led to a bit more Has his wound healed?
Well, no. No, it couldn't possibly have done. It's not really healed, and he's persuaded to take an extensive period of leave between early September and November of 1917.
Now, this marks that this incident is actually the end of the great Richtofen air period in one sense. There is a bit of a return to form, but his rate of kills falls sharply. If you look at it, he shot down 57 aircraft in the 11 months leading to 6th of July, but he'd only shoot down another 23 in the 9 months left of his career. And yes, you've got to take September and November, October, November out, but still that's a slowing down. After his long leave, he begins to recover. What's he still got in one sense?
Well, he's still got the flying skills, Pete. He's despite his earlier injury, he's still got the eyesight and the tactical awareness.
Yep,
He's got the gunnery ability, and underpinning all of this, he's got courage, Pete. He's also a superb teacher, and he's trying to inculcate the same merits in everybody who served with him. Now, there's a lot of parallels here, Pete, that strike me with some of the British pilots. Manock, for example, springs to mind.
Particularly Manock, yeah. The British Richtofen.
There's a lot of parallels here in how he's behaving, how he's passing on his skill sets, but also how he's breaking his own rules now.
That is the thing. When replacement pilots arrive, he'd have them. They'd just go around practice flights. He'd want it, monitor them. They'd almost learn to fly again. He'd practice the simple manoeuvres they need. Richtofen constantly watching them, looking for strengths and weaknesses, removing those who weren't good enough, fitting them into the formation. And his attack tactics are really simple, and that they are just a summation of Bulker's famous dicta. And this is where you're going to read them. This is what Richtofen is recorded of saying.
I dive out of the sun at him, taking into consideration the wind direction. Whoever reaches the enemy first has the privilege to shoot. The whole flight goes down with him. So-called cover at great altitude is a cloak for cowardice. If the first attacker has gun trouble, then it is the turn of the second or the third, and so on. Two must never fire at the same time.
Now, people are sometimes confused. Why can't you have two? For sure, concentration of fire. But if you're aiming at the same target, as you get nearer, you're likely to run into each other because it's a very small. Your wings will hit, so it's important. Now, Rick, as formation leader, Richtofen and Manock and McCudden and all these great aces was the cutting edge, the formation leader. So he remains the protege of Bulker. What does he say? He sums it all up in... let's carry on.
The subject aerial battle technique can be explained with one sentence. Namely, I approach the enemy from behind to within 50 metres. I aim carefully, fire, and the enemy falls. These were the words used in explanation by Bulker when I asked him his trick. Now I know that this is the whole secret of aerial victory. One does not need to be a clever pilot or a crack shot. One only needs the courage to fly in close to the enemy before opening fire. Now, you could paraphrase that, Pete, as always from above, never from below, always from behind, or whatever the comment was.
Manock's thing.
It's exactly the same.
And you dive down, you unsuspecting enemy, either out of cloud, out of the sun, or from the wrong direction. You take maximum impact in your dive with your best shot, i.e. Richtofen first, and then Richtofen would fly higher and watch the thing, watching for easy kills. And generally also what you're doing is monitoring the situation. He's leading. He's acting as a focus to reassemble a formation and assess what's going on, as a leader should, of course. Now, back at the airfield, Richtofen would analyse any incident, any conflict, and debrief and give practical tutorial advice on scout tactics, if you like. But what do you think his influence is generally amongst German pilots at this time?
Well, basically, he's brought up a whole generation of German aces, hasn't he, under this regime of comradeship tempered by strict discipline. You know, his influence increasingly all pervasive right across the German Air Force on the Western Front.
Do you think perhaps he should have been withdrawn from the front and used as a figurehead and trainer? Or
yeah, again, there's a parallel with Manock here, isn't there? That why weren't they removed from the front, as it were, and used to inspire others on the home front? But they don't want that themselves, do they, Pete?
Not really. And as 1918, you've got the great German spring offensives, haven't you? Is Richtofen the man to stand on the sidelines during the greatest fight of his country? And you've got a most wonderful quote, which I think sums it up.
I should consider myself a despicable creature if, now that I am loaded with fame and decorations, I should consent to live on as the pensioner of my own dignity and to preserve my valuable life for the nation, while every poor fellow in the trenches who is doing his duty just as much as I am has to stick it out.
Now, I think this is entirely admirable. And I admire it. He could have escaped, and he could have not flown. He could have carried on commanding. He was a Rittmeister. He could have carried on commanding Jagdwerder 1 without flying. And when Göring takes over, Hermann Göring, who's you may have heard of, he doesn't fly. But Richtofen does. By this time, what's he flying? Well, he's flying the Fokker triplane. Now, you hear a lot about the Fokker triplane. It's very manoeuvrable, but it's not exceptional. It's based, funnily enough, on the Sopwith triplane from 1917. It's not a great aircraft. He should have been in a Fokker D7, I think. Whatever he should have been in a Fokker. During that spring, he's soon in the thick of action, isn't he? And do you know what? By this time, he seems to be getting back on top form, doesn't he? Do you not think... But one sign of where air fighting is in the whole scheme of things is it's very telling. What does he have to do during the climax of the battle? What does he have to do?
Well, even he's obliged to join in the highly dangerous strafing of the British retreating columns, which is a useful reminder at this point that the ground war's king.
In other words, even your greatest aces have to come down and machine gun British Tommies, British columns, because that's where the real war is. No disrespect to air fighters, but they're in the air for the men on the ground.
Why did you have me say the word strafing,
Pete? Because I say strafing, and I'm not sure which is right. Now, April 1918, Richtofen seems to be on top, irresistible form, and his efforts peak on the 20th of April. Well, they would do. He claims his 79th and 80th victories. Now, what was that song go? Yes. He seems to be at the peak of his powers, but perhaps he should have gone somewhere else. But he's determined to fight on. Do you think he's got target fixation at all? That's what happens to people like Manock, McCudden, Ball.
Yeah, he must have been looking at 100 at this point, Pete, mustn't he?
They never rest. Yeah, whatever. Well, what's the next day after the 20th of April?
It's the 21st of April, Pete.
Ooh, I wonder what's going to happen. 21st of April, 1918. Well, that day, three flights of Sopwith Camels from 209 Squadron. Notice there's many more aircraft in the air in 1918. It's packed with aircraft. They're carrying out an offensive patrol over the Somme, and they got into a dogfight with Jagdwerder 1. Now, amongst them was Lieutenant Wilfred May. He's an inexperienced pilot, and he'd been firmly ordered to stay out of dogfights. But he was sucked into the fray. To him, he doesn't know what's going on. It's just a blur. And he's a next to useless make weight. In fact, he's not next to useless. I want to see if you can spot where he goes wrong with his tactics and what his mates must have thought of him. He's Canadian, but I can't do a Canadian accent, so I think I'll use just an idiot's voice. Now, how do you speak? Anyway, here we go. Lieutenant Wilfred May, 209 Squadron. The enemy's aircraft were coming at me from all sides. I seemed to be missing some of them by inches. There seemed to be so many of them. The best thing I thought to do was to get into a tight vertical turn, hold my guns open and spray as many as I could. So he's spinning round, just shooting. Can you imagine his red gun? What bastard shooting at me? Oh, it's him. The fight was at very close quarters. There seemed to be dozens of machines round me. Through lack of experience, I held my guns open too long. One jammed, and then the other. I couldn't clear them, so I spun out of the mess and headed west into the sun for home. After I levelled off, I looked round, but nobody was following me. I was patting myself on the back, feeling pretty good getting out of that scrape. This wasn't to last long, and the first thing I knew, I was being fired on from the rear. I couldn't fight back, fortunately, so all I could do was try and dodge the attacker. I noticed it was a red triplane. But if I'd realised it was Richthofen, I would probably have passed out on the spot. That is an entirely honest account. I love it. He's desperately trying to get home. He's trying to shake off this red triplane. Are you not going to give us Richthofen's comments on this attack, Gary?
No, not at the moment.
You seem to be strangely silent in your Richthofen voice. Anyway, his predicament is seen by his fellow Canadian, and this is Captain Roy Brown. He's a man who you always have to mention he's got stomach ulcers. I have no idea why, but he's suffering from combat stress. He's got stomach ulcers. He sees his mate in trouble, and he flies down. He's got 9 victories to his credit. And you're going to be Captain Roy Brown, 209 Squadron.
Dived on pure red triplane, which was firing on Lieutenant May. I got a long burst into him, and he went down vertical and was observed to crash by Lieutenant Mellish and Lieutenant May.
Now, that's the end of the action for Brown. That's part of a combat report. He had no idea it was Richthofen, and he flies off to join up with Mellish and May before returning to the airfield. However, it's generally accepted that whatever Brown thought was happening, Richthofen carried on pursuing May for some time after this incident. And this is Lieutenant May, who's getting increasingly desperate. I kept on dodging and spinning, I imagine for about 12,000 feet, until I ran out of sky and had to hedgehop over the ground. Richthofen was firing at me continually. The only thing that saved me was my poor flying. I didn't know what I was doing myself. I don't suppose that Richthofen could figure out what I was going to do. I love that. What's Richthofen doing? What? Fly? Following down to hedgehog?
He's breaking his own rules, isn't he?
Well behind British lines, unsupported, on his own. The next person to evolve is Sergeant Cedric Popkin. He's on the ground. Now, as they're flying along, imagine two planes flying along. He's on the left-hand side of Richthofen's Fokker. You're going to be Sergeant Cedric Popkin, 24th Australian Machine Gun Company.
I opened fire immediately. The British plane left my sights and followed the Fritz around. It would be perhaps 100 to 120 yards in front of me when I opened fire in about 200 to 400 feet in the air. It would be below the top of the ridge, which is about 500 to 600 feet high.
Oh, Lieutenant May's got no idea what's happening. He's flying along, dodging trees, ridges, and he's just trying to get away. It's all he's trying to do. Richthofen climbs over the ridge. It's he's in close pursuit. And then there's another claimant for the honour of shooting him down. And this is Gunner Robert Bui, 53rd Battery, 14th Australian Field Artillery Brigade. And he's in a Lewis machine gun post on the high ground of Moreland Court Ridge. Now, I want you to listen to this, Gary, and see what you think of this chap's truthfulness. This is what he says. At 200 yards with me, peep shite, directly on Richtofen's body, I began firing with steady bursts. I knew that the bullets were striking the right side and front of the machine, for I clearly saw fragments flying. Still, Richtofen came on, firing at Lieutenant May with both barrels blazing. Then, just before my last shots finished at a range of 40 yards, Richtofen's gun stopped abruptly. The thought flashed through my mind. Ah, oh, him! Now, what do you think about that?
Well, he's got very good eyesight to be able to see all of that while he's in the midst of an action, and he's firing head-on to the machine.
Yeah, and the Richtofen's going at 100-odd miles an hour, which is basically, this takes place in... It's bollocks. It's bollocks. But anyway, he is immediately in front of Richtofen, so the bullets would hit the front of the cockpit. We then, Richtofen at this point, turns sharply back, reversing his course and heading back to the German lines. A bit late, isn't it? And then Popkin has a second burst at him. Now, this time, if you think about it, he's on the right-hand side. He was on the left-hand side, but now he's reversing. He's going back. He's on the right-hand side. What are you going to say this time, Popkin?
I hadn't fired a second time at the peak of his turn. I don't think I was firing so long the second time as the first. I would be firing about half to three-quarters a minute each time.
Yeah, and then the red triplane crashes into the ground near a brick kiln. So, to sum up, Richtofen was shot down by Brown from behind, by Popkin from below and on the left, by Bui from straight ahead and slightly below, or Popkin, second burst, from below on the right. Or who else could have shot him down with a 303 bullet?
Any British or Australian soldier on the ground.
Because what bullet is used by the Lewis gun, the Vickers gun and everything else?
303.
Now, Richtofen was definitely dead, and he seemed, most believe he was dead before the triplane hit the ground. There's always stories that he has last word, but I think he was dead. There's no autopsy. How do they check for how he died? Take me through the detailed medical examination.
Well, they just sort of put a bit of wire in to probe the passage of the bullet and have a guess at the sort of track that it follows.
It's a coat hanger. Straightened out coat hanger. And that's all they do. So let's make it quite clear. The medical examination is crap. Apparently, from that, it shows the bullet entered from slightly behind and it goes through the right armpit, i.e. from the right, and it comes through the chest by the left nipple.
And it's only now, one round. He's only hit by one round.
One hit, which contradicts Bui, who reckons he's hit him loads of times. Now, I want you to think, is there anything in your body, Gary, of any importance between the right armpit and the left nipple? Yes, but it's almost a medical question. Could Richtofen, with a bullet through the right armpit and through to the left nipple, have lived for 60 seconds as he travelled some 1,500 yards from the point where Captain Roy Brown last attacked him to where he pulled up and crashed? Now, some say he could, some say he couldn't. I don't know, and I don't think... What's the point of idiots like us commenting? We know nothing about medicine.
I mean, I dare say it's not impossible, but you're referring to the fact that he's gone through a vital organ.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what... I mean, that's the level of my medical organ, my knowledge. There's definitely something important inside your chest. Now, Popkins claim... Let's go through them. So, Brown, well, medically difficult. He could have hit him from behind and on the right because their airplanes are jinking about. He could have. Popkin, from the left. Could the bullet have circled round and hit him in the right armpit, Gary?
No, it's only the second occasion.
Yeah, so not the first time. What about Robert Bui?
Well, no, we said while we were talking, he's directly in front and the machine's moving at 100 miles an hour.
Now, he could have done it, I suppose, when the machine turned round, but he says he did it from the front. He also says that he saw the body and it was riddled with bullets. He's a liar.
He's wrong.
He's a liar. All right. So what about Popkin the second round, the second burst?
Well, yeah, a lot of people say that it must have been Sergeant Popkin after he turned back and therefore presented his right-hand side to him. But it's a remarkable deflection shot at the range that he's talking about.
Now, explain to the punters what a deflection shot is.
Can't fire directly at the target because it's moving. And again, you mentioned it's moving at 100 mile per hour right across his line of sight. And if he did it, arguably it's accidental.
It would be a hell of a shot. He'd have to shoot well ahead.
He would.
So I don't think anyone will ever know who shot down Richtofen. And I can't be bothered with it myself.
He was definitely dead.
He was definitely dead, and that's it. I have a personal belief. As you know, Gary, I'm from many places, but one of the places I'm from is Durham. And I've always believed that it was a stray member of the Durham Light Infantry strolling across the battlefield, and he looks up and he says these immortal words before doing the deed. What are those immortal words, Gary?
Why are you, red fucker?
And do you know what? That's as likely as other ideas.
I can't believe that you've managed to manoeuvre that into a podcast about Richtofen.
Gary, don't get sucked into the irrelevancies. What is the real point of all this? What had Richtofen done?
Well, again, we mentioned it earlier, and it seems to be a theme with some of the higher scoring aces. He'd started to make a catalogue of errors that were in direct contradiction of his own dicta by this stage. It's not just Bolker's dicta by this stage. It's his own dicta. And it was suicidal to pursue a scout so low down over the British lines. With 40 machine guns and a heavy fire from the ground and under attack from an unseen scout on his tail. Oh, you know, he doesn't know who that is. And as it happens, it was an ace in his own right.
So, in one sense, what we're saying is, we don't know where the bullet came from, but the bullet was coming from somewhere. It was unlikely he'd get out of that alive. Now, what happens after the thing? Well, Richtofen, he was buried with all honours at Bertrandcourt, I think, and the men of the RAF, because it's the RAF by this time, were very ambivalent about Richtofen. And many have sought to decry his achievement, and that tradition lingers on long after the war. In fact, it still goes on today. They consider there's nothing about Richtofen that's worthy of respect. And one popular viewpoint, it's spouted by idiots, and it still persists amongst the terminally stupid to this day on forums and things on the internet. This is Second Lieutenant Walter Woods of 29 Squadron. And this lad just gets everything wrong.
This Count Richtofen you mentioned, Dad, is nothing to worry about. He will soon be brought down. Believe me, every machine of ours he has brought down has been a slow, old artillery observation machine, practically incapable of defending itself.
And I saw the same thing on a Facebook page, exactly the same slurs spouted out by an idiot recently. There's endless accusations. He's a murderer. He preys on defenceless prey. He's evil. His victories are spoon-fed to him by his henchmen. I think it's more Goering. I mean, one idiot on Facebook actually suggested he wasn't a brave man. Do you think Richtofen was a brave man?
Anyone who got into them machines at that time was brave just to get up there. No, and he was doing his duty for his country as he saw it in the best way that he could.
Yeah. About the claims, he claimed 80 kills. There's not much doubt about nearly all of these. And I don't say this is... I haven't done the work. Modern researchers, people like Trevor Henshaw, people like... I can't remember names. There's loads of them. They have gone through and they've assigned names and aircraft to almost every one of his claimed victories or kills, however you like. He stands acclaimed as an ultimate scout pilot, as a formation leader par excellence. What's his job, Gary? Sum up his job.
Well, basically, he's got to sweep the Allied observation aircraft from the skies, and he did it to the very best of his ability. We keep coming back to what's the role of the aircraft, the primary role, and he was there to deny the aircraft that opportunity.
Now, why are the army cooperation so important to the ground war?
Well, because without them, the casualties on the ground are going to increase. We've mentioned, you know, before that the The joint between the Royal Flying Corps, RAF, and the artillery is the primary relationship here, because it saves lives on the ground. And
kills Germans.
Kills Germans, absolutely.
So they are the ultimate enemy, and that's why Richthofen seeks them out. The BE-2C, the RE-8, they are the ultimate killing machines, not because of themselves, but because of the wireless and the observer and the contact with the real killing machine, the Royal Artillery. That's why Richthofen seeks them out. Did you think it's because he wants a gruesome souvenir? He collected souvenirs from the aircraft, or his specially struck silver hunting cups that he had before they began to run out of silver? Do you think that's why they were? No. It's because they're the real enemy, isn't it? Do you think he's a cold-hearted murderer, Gary?
No, he's a man fighting to the very best of his considerable abilities in the cause of his country, as I mentioned earlier. And like most of the German aces, and in fact quite a lot of the Allied aces, he pays the inevitable penalty of fighting against the odds in crowded skies.
And I think we owe him our respect, and people shouldn't just trash his reputation just on without thinking about what a wonderful pilot he was. He was a killing machine, but he was killing in the cause of his country, and we have to respect what he did. I've always had a lot of time for Richthofen, and do you know something, just to change the mood, he was gorgeous.
He was very pretty.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for joining me today. And I'm grateful for you for letting me join you.
Cheers, Pete.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?